Well, good day and welcome to another episode here of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the pod medic, and we are back with an action-packed episode tonight, bringing you somebody from almost a quarter of the way around the world, not halfway, but a quarter of the way around the world, which is far enough in many cases. Anyway, before we can get to that, though, we have to go the other direction and go like an eighth of the way around the world to Sam in Colorado. Hey, Sam.
Well, it may seem that way to you, Jamie, but it's not really. It's good here. I think fall is finally making its way into Colorado right now, and that just works fine for me. But speaking of the weather, oh my God, we have so much. I get these NOAA alerts every time a hurricane appears or is upgraded or downgraded, and my phone's been blowing up. And the only person who can probably explain what's really happening out there up to the moment is Becky DePodwin. Hi, Becky.
Hey, Sam. How goes it?
Pretty good. So what's up with these hurricanes?
Well, we are in the peak of hurricane season, which is typically September, October, even a little bit into August. So, but really September and October are the key months. And both basins, Pacific and Atlantic, and even all the way out into the West Pacific are living up to that. We have Hurricane Norman, which is out in the Pacific, off to the east of Hawaii, but no threat to Hawaii, thankfully. It's going to veer off to the north. And then we'll get to the most significant at the last. We have Florence, which is now a Category 1 hurricane, out in the middle of the Atlantic. At this point, not a threat to land, but certainly bears watching. Bermuda looks like the most likely spot for this storm to hit. That wouldn't be until early next week at the earliest. And then, of course, Tropical Storm Gordon. And by the time anybody is listening to this, Gordon will have made landfall. In fact, it's going to make landfall very shortly, sometime this evening. Currently still a tropical storm. Slight chance for it to be upgraded to a Category 1 hurricane. But regardless, the main impacts are going to remain the same. Heavy flooding rains, damaging winds, although not as bad as it could have been. In theory, probably winds to 70 miles per hour, 80 miles per hour, right up there with like a severe thunderstorm. Maybe a bit more intense. And also isolated tornadoes, especially right along the coast. A lot of times these tropical systems like to spin up pretty transient tornadoes as they make landfall. So heavy flooding rains for the Gulf Coast. That's southern Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, even up into Arkansas a little bit. We'll be experiencing heavy rainfall.
Awesome. Well, it looks like Sam dropped off the call here for a second, so we'll see if we can get her back up here. But I actually, you know, I have a question because, you know, this is coming on the shore. Even though it's not yet upgraded to a hurricane status, doesn't mean that the impacts won't be significant in many ways.
Correct. Yeah, it's really just a difference of a few miles per hour in wind speed. And that's not going to make that much of a difference in terms of the main impact, which is the heavy flooding rainfall, even a little bit of storm surge right along the immediate coast. So it's just the name tropical storm versus a hurricane. I wouldn't focus on that. I would focus on the impacts and what you can do to be prepared.
Excellent. And Joe, it looks like it's going to like curve right around Tennessee, according to the map I'm looking at. So it should miss western Tennessee and Memphis, it looks like.
Well, we may not get much. They're predicting some scattered, you know, rain and that sort of stuff over the next several days. But I don't think anything too significant for us, but we could use the rain.
Awesome. Well, Becky, thank you very much. Are you going to stay on the call with us and join the discussion?
Absolutely. I'm interested to hear what James has to say.
Awesome. And we have Sam back. You've joined us again.
Yeah. My Skype got weird there for a minute, but that's okay. Anyway, yes, moving right along. We have an amazing guest tonight. And the funny part is this guy has been an active member of our Facebook group and been, you know, he made a comment to me. It's about, you know, nobody did a podcast like this. And then I found you. But what's even funnier is in that discourse, he mentions as he was, you know, moving from island to island where he is, who was he listening to in 2007? The Pod Medic. I thought that was pretty cool. So
I've been doing this just a little while.
Just a little while, yes. But to think you're out there in the middle of the ocean somewhere a quarter of the way across the world. It just reminds me, you know, how much reach we actually have. We have a lot of international listeners, which we are going to hear from this month, potentially. So anyway, we have James Corbin, and I'm so excited to talk to him. Boy, I thought Joe Hawley was a busy guy, or Seth Hawkins. This guy would rival both of you. So we're going to jump in and just ask a lot of questions about what he does. So hi, James.
Well, thanks, Sam. Thanks, Joe, Becky, Jamie. It's really a pleasure to be here. I'm happy to be able to talk to you all tonight.
So tell them where you are exactly at this moment.
Well, so I am in Western Africa, specifically in the country of Benin. And Benin is just to the west of Nigeria. Most people can picture sort of in the off the west coast of Africa where Nigeria is. And it's a small relative to Africa. It's a fairly small country. I'm on the coast. I'm in not the capital, but the main port city of Cotonou. I've been out here for about 9 months, almost exactly 9 months, working on my friend. Benin is in addition to the regional African dialects, it's a former French colony, so it's a Francophone country. I spoke pretty passable Spanish coming from southern Arizona, but I've been struggling. I'm finally to the point where I can get by on some basic conversations. So.
Good deal. Yeah, you're going to know a lot of languages by the time you've run around exactly. The world a few times. I've kind of dissected your life as you gave it to me in email, and I'm just fascinated with all the stuff you've done. So Jamie probably knows where this is, but you started out life volunteering as an EMT in Montgomery County in Maryland at the Wheaton Volunteer Rescue Squad. And at the same time, you're working for National Geographic. So there's two questions there. Jamie, you're familiar with the...
I know where Wheaton is. Yep. And we, you know, Maryland is a state with a strong volunteer fire and EMS tradition, and it still continues to this day. So it surprises me not that James was involved in that way. That would have been how I probably would have done it if I was in that area, too.
Well, so many of our folks start that way and move off into more interesting things, which he certainly did. So what was that experience like for you, James?
Well, coming back from I actually went to college in the Midwest and came back with a history degree. And like every proud history major, promptly moved back in with my parents. I was born and raised in the Washington, D.C. area and started working for National Geographic Society, the first job out of college, doing a lot of copy editing, doing some ghostwriting. This was not with the magazine specifically, but first with their books division and then later for the online. This was 1999, so the internet was a new thing. Everyone was trying to figure out how to get on the internet. And at the same time, I was doing a lot of recreational rock climbing. And my climbing partner at the time was a volunteer EMT who was working on his paramedic at the Wheaton Volunteer Rescue Squad. If people can picture Washington, D.C., it's basically a square on its side, almost a diamond. And Wheaton, Maryland is on the northwestern corner of Washington, D.C., encompasses a fair bit of the beltway that loops the nation's capital. So it's an area that has everything. There's a fair amount of vehicular trauma from MVCs on the beltway. Wheaton is a little bit of a different place now 20 years later, but it was kind of a knife and gun club back when I started riding there. And there are some large retirement communities that were at least within the ALS, Advanced Life Support, first due. So it was a good place to cut your teeth. But my friend, my climbing buddy, said, oh, you should come and try out the rescue squad. It's a lot of fun. And I said, no, that's not my thing. I'm not interested in that. And he was persistent. And finally, I said, okay, I'll come. I'll do a ride along on the ambulance, and you know, we can just end this conversation. And one shift on the running calls on the ambulance was all it took. It was I don't come from a family of medicine. There's no physicians, no nurses. We don't have any healthcare. Most of my family members are scientists. So healthcare EMS was something that had just literally never entered my world yet. I hadn't even considered it. And so it was walking into a whole, I think this is the experience a lot of us have in our volunteer lives, walking into something that you'd never consider professionally and realize, wow, this is an amazing experience that I know nothing about.
Sam, are you muted again?
Yeah, I pulled a Joe Hawley.
Hey.
Oh, man, throw him under the bus, why don't you?
Oh, hold on, I'm going to mute for a minute. I got some things to say.
He's the only other one that forgets to do that like me. No, I totally forgot what I was going to say. So you joined after that experience. Well, was there any profound experiences during that point in time? No, what I was going to say was, hello, I never considered getting into medicine either. I was going in a completely different direction and somehow ended up there, so one never knows. Were there any salient experiences while you were there that kind of got you more interested in moving forward in another medical direction?
I think we all have. I think we all have the calls that really resonated with us. But it was really more of the totality of the experience of running calls on a day in and day out basis. I should take a backup here and add to what Jamie said. Maryland, like a lot of the East Coast, has a really strong volunteer fire rescue tradition, but there are two large rescue squads in Montgomery County, which is the Maryland county that abuts Washington D.C. One in Bethesda Chevy Chase and one in Whedon, and both of those are all volunteer, 100% volunteer on nights, weekends, and holidays. And so that means they're putting out a heavy rescue squad. They're putting out usually two ambulances and a paramedic unit. So that's about anywhere from, I mean, skeleton crew for that is 10 to 12, and usually you need about 16. So it's a really, really strong community, and it's a busy, the year I left, now during the day, Monday through Friday, 6 a.m. to 6 p.m., there was career staffing, and obviously we couldn't have put out response units without our career staff. We had a really good relationship with them. They were county employees. But the year I left, in total, for the year, our squad ran 14,000 calls. And so for an all-volunteer station, for again, not during the weekdays when most people are at work, it's a really, really high volume. And I think Whedon continually makes it into the top two or three or four spot as the busiest rescue squad in the nation.
Well, that's a great experience too, and God bless the volunteers. I don't know what the East Coast would do without them. But at that time, you joined the Shenandoah Mountain Rescue Group as well, correct?
Right. So all along this time, I was working at National Geographic. I was also working at a local climbing gym, starting in the gym, but pretty quickly moving outside into to outdoor guiding, mostly running top rope courses, doing top rope guiding, doing some multi-pitch guiding at Seneca Rocks. For your East Coast listeners, probably know where that is in West Virginia. And then I joined the Virginia arm of the Appalachian Search and Rescue Conference. You had Keith Conover on a couple shows ago. So it's this big archipelago of rescue groups all throughout the Allegheny and Shenandoah Mountains that encompass Maryland, Pennsylvania, North Carolina. And so you can pull on a really large cohort of folks for call-outs if you need to do that. So I spent many a happy hour whacking my way through rhododendron forest and in the Shenandoah and George Washington National Forest. People always be amazed at doing search and rescue in Arizona, which I know we'll get to. But some of the most miserable calls I had were in the Shenandoah. That's really difficult terrain to traverse. It will make you earn your stripes.
Well, it sounds like you're going through Africa, right? With that machete.
Yeah, exactly.
So at the same time, you took your hobby of recreational climbing, which you just mentioned, to a profession and became a climbing guide. So what's that experience like? I've always wondered what it was like
mountain. Having worn a fair number of hats in my life, I will say being a climbing guide is probably one of the hardest jobs I've ever had. And I had a boss, the guy who was who ran the outdoor programs during one of our trainings, said, "Never forget, your clients, meaning the people who paid good money." And again, this is the DC crowd, right? So they come in with certain expectations. He said, "Never forget, your clients. They're trying to kill you, they're trying to kill themselves, and they're trying to kill everyone around them." And boy, if that isn't the truth. And so it's one half customer service, it's one half just scene management, anything to rival a big house fire, and a third half, if I can do that, of just entertainment, keeping people busy and entertained while you're setting up and taking down climbs, and keep an eye on the weather, and keeping an eye on kind of everything else that needs to happen. And so it was really my career as a rock climbing guide that gave me the good rope sense that I didn't have, because I've been rock climbing for probably 5-8 years at this point. Really, I thought it was pretty hot stuff that I knew a lot. And then you get into the rigging world of multi-pitch climbing with multiple clients, managing multiple top rope scenes, and it's a whole nother world. You just gotta it's a three-ring circus, and you gotta have a third eye in addition to a third hand. So it was immensely rewarding. I love that job, but I would come home and feel like I'd just been worked over with a sack of doorknobs.
Jamie, that's a topic we haven't really covered in the search and rescue world. As far we talk about Joe going down into things, but we don't talk much about rope work and heights and all of that. We might get him back to discuss that in more detail.
I think so. That would be great.
So now we're back in Arizona, and you went back to school for your pre-med, and you entered into an interesting master's PA program. What was the outcome of that? Tell us a bit about that program.
Yeah, so taking a step back, obviously I had my bachelor's degree, and there were the interesting thing about the rescue squad, Becky, you'll find this interesting. We had a NOAA PhD meteorologist that I rode with, whose name for the life of me is escaping. They'll come to me at 3 in the morning. But we had attorneys, we had people that worked in government, we had a dentist, we had people that work in just customer service. It was really all walks of life. But there were a couple of PAs that had started off as paramedics and went to get their physician assistant degree, but continued to ride. And I was starting to think much more seriously about a career in medicine at this point. And spending some time with them convinced me this was really, this really matched what I was thinking. Because I was of course, at the time, I thought I was an old man. I was well into my 20s, far too old.
Oh my goodness!
Yeah, can you imagine? And so at the time, my wife had finished her law. My wife is an attorney. She's a good attorney. She's a federal prosecutor. She puts bad people away. But she had finished her law degree and had gotten a clerkship, which is sort of in medical terms, almost a fellowship in the legal world, with the with the federal courts in Phoenix. So we moved out to Phoenix. It was a perfect time for me to go back and supplement my my liberal arts degree with all the prerequisites I would need for my PA program. Applied to a couple of places. Very fortunately got into one of the schools outside of Phoenix in Mesa, Arizona, which is A.T. Still, and started my PA program in 2005 and graduated in 2007, fall of 2007. At the same time, I had joined the MRA team in Maricopa County in Phoenix, the greater Phoenix area, which is Central Arizona Mountain Rescue Association, also a very, very busy team. What's really interesting about coming from East Coast Search and Rescue to West Coast, and specifically Arizona, is Arizona's got 320 beautiful flying days a year. So we're really able to use helicopters in a much more aggressive way than I was used to. And the volunteers are really heavily integrated into serving as spotters, serving as flight crew. And it's really challenging terrain. The deserts around Phoenix, it looks like Mars, and I can get up. I think the hottest it ever was on a search I was on was 119. I felt every bit of it. So.
Oh, I can imagine. Well.
And that brings up just a whole nother section we could talk about dealing with the wellness of the rescuer, right? Because if you've got a large number of rescuers out there, the logistics of keeping them hydrated and everything else in that type of heat must be daunting.
This is a huge passion of mine, actually, as I moved through, from EMT to paramedic to PA, and then eventually became responsible for most of the medical training, eventually winding up in Tucson with the Tucson team. This is really where it's at, because there's no pause on calls, right? We have calls all throughout the year. And we need to make sure our number one priority is, first of all, ourselves, but then very closely following our team members. And I have been looking really closely at the military literature that's coming out of this, and the acclimation data, and just there's no shortcuts. And this would be a great separate show to do, but the only way to acclimate for the heat is to exercise in the heat. And so it's something we really push on our team members, in because the summer in Arizona starts in March sometimes. Get out there. And that's the most dangerous time of the year is the shoulder season. So it's early summer and it's late summer when, you've had a stretch of cool days, people aren't really going out, and then you'll have a heat wave. It can be 100 degrees on Halloween in Phoenix. And then all of a sudden there's a long call out and people have lost their acclimation. Or on the front end, it's early March, and all of a sudden you have a heat wave burn through. You got a bunch of call outs and no one's really ready for the heat. So.
And that's why I live in Colorado. Thank you very much. But, I mean, it wasn't like you were sitting still out there. You did wilderness search and rescue, swiftwater rescue, which probably felt really good, cave and mine rescue, as well as your technical rope rescue.
And that's all one team. So all Mountain Rescue Association MRA teams have to cross certify in three disciplines. One is technical rock, one is alpine, and people would always laugh about, oh, the Phoenix team is here for their alpine recertification. But people don't realize how mountainous Arizona is. And even though within what you would consider the first due of the Maricopa County Mountain Rescue team, CAMRA, should use the correct name, CAMRA, Central Arizona Mountain Rescue, we have strong mutual aid agreements with Coconino County, which is in Flagstaff, and that's the highest peak in Arizona, as well as Pima County, which is where Tucson is. And there's a ski run in outside Tucson. It's the southernmost ski run in the entire United States. It's one of my favorite places to ski, because you're skiing and you're overlooking saguaro cactuses. And then you drive down the mountain, and it's 75 degrees, and you get in your hot tub, and you don't have to worry about being cold anymore.
Oh, that's crazy. So, Joe, what do you think so far?
Wow. clearly incredibly busy. I have to say, of all of this, I would be most fascinated to hear from your mountain guiding experience, sort of what are some of the common frequent things that get amateur climbers in trouble, and that sort of reference the comments that you made earlier. Are there things that you saw in that experience that were pretty commonplace, that were just sort of boneheaded kind of moves that got people in trouble on a regular basis?
Boy, I tell you what I saw. Now, the folks that I worked with as clients were, and so, they were the smart ones because they hired me, Joe.
But yes, of course.
These were generally indoor rock climbers, people that had started their climbing career in an indoor gym, and they were far better climbers than me. I mean, these were people who were climbing, you know, 5'11", 5'12", really, really high-end grades, but had never climbed outside, didn't know how to set up an anchor, didn't really know how to get from the there are a fair number of climbing areas that you can't there's no walk around. So you have to set up a top anchor and either belay from the top or set up the top anchor, rappel down, or lower your climber down and then rappel after that. And so these folks used our courses. We would teach a two-day transition to outdoor climbing where we teach them anchor building techniques, all of the things you learn in, because a lot of these principles are the same in technical rope rescue, right? Your serene principles, your anchor has to be solid, redundant, no extension, timely, all of these things. And so at the end, they would be able to very safely set up anchors, have them be robust, have them be safe, and then, you know, go off and do their outdoor climbing. Very frequently, even to this day, I was, Sam, speaking of Colorado, I would usually take a trip once a year up to Ouray, Colorado, to ice climb up there, either in the backcountry or in the park. You see all sorts of interesting climbing anchors up there. And I mean, you were not to pick on Ure, but also in any recreational climbing area, you'll see really solid anchors, and you'll see things that you just you almost don't want to look at because it's going to make them break. And years ago, I would try and talk to folks and say, "Hey, gee, you might want to think about this and that." And you know, usually people don't want to hear it, and they have a few choice words for you. And I you know, they know what they're doing, and so I kind of got out of the habit of that. What's funny is the materials are so good at this point that you can really fudge up a tap rope system and still probably have it hold. There are a lot of people that haven't gotten injured just by dumb luck, I think. But I think that's the main thing of anchoring equipment. And then I think you'll get into people who are doing multi-pitch climbing where you're going multiple rope lengths up and really haven't learned haven't been taught how to place gear. There are plenty of people that get the experience of placing gear just by following a leader and see how they place the gear. But there really is a more of an art than a science to it. And boy, yeah, I've hauled more than my share of injured climbers out of the backcountry of people that have taken ground falls because their protection pulled. And then ended up taking care of them in the hospital.
Oh, my God. Yeah, and there's a piece of that coming up. Now we're getting into the interesting stuff. But, oh, my God, there's a show, Jamie. Make a note of that. Something we haven't touched yet. So, Becky, any thoughts or questions for James so far?
I'm definitely curious if weather impacted any of these rescues and or if weather caused any incidents in the mountains. Because, obviously, mountain weather is always changing and can be pretty treacherous.
Yeah, you're exactly right. One of the Achilles heels, I think, of doing rescue in Arizona is that you almost always have the helicopter available. I have a number of friends who do search and rescue in New Hampshire, and they say, oh, geez, we get to use the helicopter maybe twice a year. So they go in assuming that the helicopter isn't going to be available. And as much as we tell ourselves that you always have to be, you always have to have a plan B, a plan C, I think more emotionally than mentally, you always think, okay, well, we're going to have the helicopter available, and then weather will move in, or it doesn't even have to be weather. A single light comes on in one of those things, and they have to turn. It doesn't matter what they're doing; they got to turn around. They got to find the nearest place to sit it down, just for safety. But when I first came out to Arizona, this was 2004, and had joined CAMRA, the Central Arizona Mountain Rescue Association, we were doing a land navigation training in the fall. And it started out, oh, man, it was this is October, bluebird day, 75 degrees, just you couldn't ask for better weather. And we knew there was a big, I think this was an El Nino year, because we knew there was a big front that was coming up from the Gulf of Mexico, but it was going to hit at the end of the weekend. Basically, we were going to be done. And whatever, somebody goosed that storm, and it got there about half, because we were, the way we do these trainings is you do land navigation courses through the day, and then sit down, have a safety break. Some people take a nap, eat something, and then we'll do a night course and usually finish up about, 2 or 3 in the morning. Well, about 1 or 2 o'clock, it started to sprinkle, and then it started to rain, and then it started to hail, and then it started to snow, and then it started to rain, and then it snowed again. And it was literally 33-degree rain. Like, just 4 degrees cooler, it would have been perfect, right? Because you'd have this white, fluffy snow all over you on the mesas of Central Arizona. But we were just getting – it's literally the worst conditions, right? It's to be wet, wet and near freezing temperatures. And just – it's funny because I had just moved from the East Coast and was used to just the most abhorrent weather conditions. And so I had a pack full of warm stuff and my raincoat of just, so I was totally ready, not because I was a superstar, just because I'd suffered enough and I hadn't really changed my pack. But yeah, we had a number of people get really profound, not, I wouldn't say profoundly hypothermic, but we got a bunch of experienced team members that got real cold real quick. It was a very good learning experience for everyone. No, everybody was fine. Everybody walked out of there. But, that was one of those experiences that you think, boy, if someone had twisted an ankle, if anything had happened, things could have gone really wrong. And that was a training exercise. It wasn't a mission. And we're just out there to train. So.
Well, we'll have you talk about what to pack on another show. Thoughts, Jamie?
No, I'm glad you brought Becky in, because I had the very same question and I was hoping she would come in with it, because I think weather is one of those things that gets left often to the last thing you think about in a rescue situation in many cases. And yet it can have a profound effect on us. I know here in Maryland, and I'm sure, James, you're aware, we call for helicopters all the time for trauma here. But they're frequently down, because especially in the summertime, because of thunderstorms that come up, that crop up all of a sudden. And you think it's fine, but you don't realize there's a thunderstorm between you and Baltimore, so the helicopter's down. And you have to make those arrangements. And I often think that maybe weather needs to be part of a dispatch sequence, just to give people an idea of what's available, what's not, and what to expect when they, over the course of maybe a 40-minute rescue.
Well, I would say a full 30% of our rescues in southern Arizona have weather as a component to them, because so speaking now about Tucson, Tucson's obviously, Phoenix is a university town, but Tucson is a big university town because it's a much smaller city, and so the university population takes up a much larger component. So in the fall, the students are back, they're out hiking, they're out recreating, the hiking trails, the mountain biking trails, the outdoor recreation around Tucson is phenomenal. I'd put it up against anywhere I've ever lived or visited. But you can set out on the trail. It would be 80, 85 degrees, 90 degrees, but you can very easily, and Becky knows this, I'm sure, you can very easily have 40-degree temperature swings in the desert. So the hike will take longer than people expect. Or they'll get a late start, right? So, okay, well, let's meet at 8, and, you know, their one friend doesn't show up until 8:30, and then they get chatting, and then someone has to go to the bathroom. So they haven't started until, you know, 9:30, close to 10. And it's always farther than you think it's going to be. If people remember anything, it's always farther than you think it's going to be. So anyway, they become benighted, and they don't have a bunch of stuff. They don't have water, they don't have food, but they don't have a light source. And they don't have extra clothing, extra layering. So they're in tank tops and they're in shorts. And now it's 50 degrees and they are freezing. And these patients can become profoundly hypothermic in Arizona in what's effectively the summer. Weather is a big part of our life.
And that's going to wrap up this episode of the Disaster Podcast. We got talking with James about so much stuff that we decided to shift this episode over into two different episodes. So we're going to pick up where the next episode in next week's show. So please stay tuned for that. In the meantime, I want to thank, as always, Paragon Medical Education Group and Joe Holly and the rest of the team there for their continued sponsorship of the Disaster Podcast. We wouldn't be here without them. So do me a favor, head over and say thank you to them. Shoot them an email or head over to their Facebook group and leave a message saying thanks for Disaster Podcast support. And also to check in with them. I don't think you realize all the ways that they can provide a very unique and interesting educational experience for your system in a very cost-effective way. But you need to reach out to them and talk about how they can customize exactly what you need with the resources you have available. So reach out to them at paragonmedicalgroup.com. You can also find them at paragonmedEDU on Twitter. And of course, over at disasterpodcast.com. I'm Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic. I'll be back soon with another episode, as I said, next week, picking up with episode 2 of this segment on Mountain Rescue with our guest, James Corbin. And until then, I just want to remind all of you that disaster medicine is not your everyday medicine.